Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples.
Anyone else feel like they're talking like this time of year and sneezing and coughing and annoying your family while you're watching TV like I'm sure I do?
Well, yeah, I know that I am because my kids tend to tell me. Luckily for those of us who live with these symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease in as little as a half an hour, by the way. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, hello, everybody. You are listening to Judging Megan with your host, Megan Judge. I am going to start today. I'm so excited about my guest. I've already chatted with her prior. We've had a couple bumps in the road getting together to be able to record, but I'm so looking forward to this episode and for my listeners to hear her. I'm going to introduce her in a second, but I'm going to start out by telling you, as a mother, there is nothing, and I might even bring in Candy because she's a mom herself, worse than when your kid has the stomach bug. Last night, my daughter woke up on top of me already being sick for days, woke up throwing up. And as a parent, there's nothing worse than when your kid calls you and says, "Mom, I just threw up." It's like it's the worst thing ever. Candy, do you agree? I have to just ask you this. You're a mom. You had kids, right? I
mean, you know, the old joke was I'll take a, you know, cat hairball any day instead of your kid being, well, in either direction. I mean, you know, food poisoning or the other end. I mean,
oh, it's the worst.
Well, you can't keep up with it.
Well, thank God now they have, what is that medicine that they have? There's a medicine that you can give so they're not, you know, when you get the stomach bug and you're so sick that gagging. I forget what it's called. Makes you stop throwing up.
Yeah, right.
So let me just tell you. So my husband, who I was in a fight with last night before this happened, because that's what happens sometimes when we're married. He last time she was sick, she had a stomach bug like a month and a half ago, and I had to be up all night cleaning it up, and it was so gross. But they never, when they're little, can make the toilet, and Ella's just 9, so she just threw up all over her bed like multiple times, and I feel so guilty because I sat in my room and I just locked the door. I'm the worst. I'm so bad. But I was like, it's your turn. Hid.
Well, changing poop diapers and
right,
kids throw up, you know,
that's the top two.
Yeah. And you top know two. My son used to get car sick, And we'd go down one of the canyons here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Like Laurel Canyon or something. And he'd go, and I mean, I'd say,
and you know,
I need a little warning. I don't need one day. And so I, you know, I'd have him like strap, you know, like a grocery store bag over his ears. Just go when we get down there, we'll do something about it.
It's all over your car. My older one gets that.
There's no way to like park and move over.
No, you cannot on our canyons. If you live in Los Angeles, you know what we're talking about. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go. You're stuck.
You can't pull over. And, you know, it's like, and then you have to roll the window down, put your head out the window, then it goes
yeah.
outside of the car. No, it's not a good thing.
It's not fun. So no. I feel like my husband should get a medal, even though I'm mad at him and I'm still mad at him from last night. I should probably be nicer because he really did do a good job last night. But I was like, it's your turn. It's your turn. And I just went back in my room and got in bed. I feel so bad. But that's how
I don't think I feel that bad.
I don't really feel that bad.
Probably once in a marriage, they'll do it. So, you know, you have your own.
I happen to have a husband that, thankfully, I'll give him this. He's very good with that kind of stuff. I know that I have friends that their husbands do.
Oh, no, my husband. I just lost my husband.
I know. You told me.
But, he would gag right along with him. So it wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, and he'd hold his nose and carry on. So I'd go, I don't want you sick too, you know?
Yeah, because then it goes through the whole house. So I'm just praying to baby Jesus right now.
I know.
Please do not let all of us get the stomach bug. I'm literally at my wit's end right now. So I'm going to start out the podcast with that little story.
We've all been put here for a reason and we all deserve acceptance.
Judging Megan with Megan Judge.
I'm a trauma survivor from a really young age and I have been diagnosed with complex PTSD in the past few years. I've been surrounded by death and abuse much of my life. I've been dragged through the mud and have been to the point of not wanting to go on anymore. Through my interviews with other survivors, I've learned that there is a way out. From recovering to surviving and thriving, we all have the strength to come out the other side.
You are listening to Judging Megan.
I'm going to introduce you all to Candy Finnegan. Candy is best known from A&E's Intervention. So welcome, Candy, to my podcast. So honored to have you.
I'm so honored to be here.
So let me just start with this. I watched Intervention, and any one of my listeners or audience that might be listening right now, it's still airing. It's been airing for years and years. It is a show that, I mean, I can say Candy has saved many, many, many lives. And addiction is just so painful in our country. You know, the suicide rates are higher than they've ever been. The suicide rates in children are higher than they've ever been. I talk a lot about the homeless issue, the mental health issue. That's why I do this every week, because we are in a mental health crisis. Mental health is obviously walks hand in hand with addiction. My older sister, I don't know if I told you this, Candy, lost one of her very best friends. She did everything she could. And our friend Denise Klein, who's a saint, ended up, you know, just out of like the kindness of her heart, trying to help my sister and her friend get clean, get into a sober facility. He went into rehab. He couldn't do it. And he passed away last month. And my sister, Michelle, did everything to try and save him. And I know that if you have watched Intervention, it's very painful for people to watch. It's not an easy show for people to watch. But addiction is at the highest rate and crisis that we've ever had in the United States. Am I correct on that?
Well, absolutely, because of the way that drugs are getting in. I mean, when fentanyl started coming in through China, it was in little dibbles and dabbles. I mean, like, you know, a pound here, a pound there. It's dirt cheap to produce. So cheap. And so it was like nobody knew why people were like taking a snort of it, smoking it, whatever they were doing. And bam, they were gone. Yeah. And then you started having accidents like a police officer coming into a house and busting them and picking something up with their bare hand. It was absorbed to the skin. They were dead in 10 minutes. So it was a drug we'd never seen, although fentanyl is produced in the United States under very high clinical, and it is the only drug that has five separate means of you taking it. There's a patch, there's nose spray, there's a sucker. There's a, like a little, you know, C's sucker. And then there's IV, and then there's a pill form. No other drug has all of those means. It is a end-of-life drug. It was mainly given in hospice because so many people had an allergic reaction to morphine, and you built up such a tolerance to morphine in like tiny space that it was more and more and more, which eventually just a little bit more and it was gone. So in that sense, when this father and son team started producing it in China and getting it in, you know, there was an occasional overdose. But when the cartel got involved, heroin addiction is down 65%.
Okay.
Because people are just getting hooked on fentanyl.
So the thing is, because I've done episodes about fentanyl, and a friend of mine who came on the podcast lost her son because they're targeting young kids on Snapchat. And, you know, he went and bought a Xanax online.
That's exactly what happened to my daughter's friend. She had never taken a pill ever. She was dead.
So what's confusing, I think, as a parent, because the schools, thank God, are finally waking up. So that's why I'm wondering, and going backwards a little bit, the crisis is higher than ever because the fentanyl is so cheap to make. The cartel has its hands on it. They're targeting young kids. Narcan, which we're just hearing over the past week, is going to be, over just walking into a drugstore.
I've been a Narcan carrier for at least 5 years. I met this wonderful woman who I hope someday you'll interview. Her name is Amy Dunkel, and she's in Orange County, and she was picking up her son from treatment, and his best friend got there first, and he died instantly because he'd been clean too. And so she started this, the Solace Foundation, and she goes down every Saturday to the homeless and hands it out and teaches them. She's saved probably a couple thousand lives since her son died, Ben. And I met her at a conference, and then I just became attached to her. I had her come do everything I did. It's a 10-minute learning. She has a carte blanche through the Narcan company, and she'll send it to you. My kids are in their early 40s, and I make them carry it. I mean, I just don't know. You could look out on the street and see somebody, you know, gone.
It's terrifying. It's a terrifying, scary, scary drug. And I think the more education that, you know, the schools, parents.
Well, the schools weren't allowed to have it on campus.
Well, now they are now. My kids actually go to a Catholic school, and they're even starting to talk about and have talks about it, which is, you know, I was kind of shocked by that. But this is like going backwards. This is a huge crisis in our country. People need to wake up. You know, you hear about these stories every single day. But they
started like putting it in cocaine.
Yeah.
Because I've had a friend whose wife had not gotten high for a really long time. She's under a real pressure television job. She had to have a deadline. she called an old friend of hers. He brought it over. She, you know, did two lines of it and was dead in 5 seconds.
Well, it's shocking to me that first of all, adults, you know, parents like are still even touching the stuff. But that's me just being very Pollyanna. I mean, I'm scared to even take too many Advil in a day. So,
it's funny because there was such an abuse with Vicodin for so long. And, I did interventions on two or three different people, like two or three different times. They were taking like 35, 45 Vicodin a day. And so because of the acetaminophen in it, which is 350 milligrams, you take, 15 of them. You're only supposed to have 1,500 milligrams of acetaminophen a day. And here you are. You're now up to like 12,000.
How are these people even walking around? Like, that's what I don't understand. But I want to talk more about this, but I want to hear about you because it's weird in life how people, you could watch a TV show or meet somebody and people come into your lives for different reasons. But you, for some reason, I have not watched the show, to be honest, in several years, but I could tell that you were a firecracker when I would watch the show. Like, you're like no mess around, but you yourself, I don't know if people know this that watch the show, are clean, right? You're sober.
Yeah, I'm 36 years.
And I would love to kind of start out and hear about you because that's what I wanted you to come on to talk about. So let me hear about like where you're from and kind of your early life and we'll move on.
Well, I'm adopted and I was adopted, strangely enough, a strange story, but I am from Kansas and yes, I know Dorothy and those guys. I probably dated them all, those little scarecrows and all those people. I was adopted into a very privileged family, which was, nothing could be better, I guess, and everything in every color. And my parents had lost a biological child to polio. It was in the 40s and there was a rampant epidemic of polio and they lost their only biological child. And they flew in iron lungs and they did everything possible, but she had pyloric polio and it usually suffocates you within 2 weeks. She was seven. So then a year later, they adopted my brother. And then 2 years later, they adopted me. So I had this thing about being a replacement child. It was my imagination. They never said, oh, there's our replacement daughter. Because losing a child, and when you can't save them, it's very different than overdosing. It's a disease that we knew nothing about. And my family and my grandparents put in hundreds of thousands of dollars to Salk to get the polio vaccine up and ready. So I grew up in a very active, I always jokingly said my mother did lunch and my dad did golf, but there was a little more to it than that.
Yeah.
My mother was who's who in society. And all the stuff that if you look at me now, you go, you are a debutante. But, I did the best I could to fit in and I'm a chameleon. So wherever we had houses in Colorado, an apartment in New York, and I just went, oh, and that's this outfit and that'll be here. I'll be Oakley Annie. So I fit in really well, which came in such good play when I was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a girls' convent Catholic school, was very close with Mother Superior, spent a lot of time with her because I smoked in my uniform.
Oh, no.
It was a wool uniform. I smelled like a little smudge pot, but I like smoking. So I thought, don't tell me what to do, one of those. And I got along really well with her. I actually became very close with her. She was also a redhead. I just couldn't tell because she had a habit on. And I can tell you that I guess I got an education. I got most outstanding senior girl because my parents got 5 new TVs for the convent and a new lawn. So, I mean, how do you not win with that? So what I couldn't do, they supplemented, let me put it that way. So I went to a girls finishing school in Columbia, Missouri called Stevens. And in 2 weeks,
I know Stevens. That's so funny because one of my very best friends, her sister went to Stevens and she's from Columbia, Missouri too. Yeah, I'm very friendly.
And I was finished in 2 weeks.
Uh-oh.
I didn't want to go with any more women. They didn't tell me you couldn't have a car, but you could have a plane and a horse. Well, where's my plane? You know, you need to tell me these things. So I just called my dad and I said, I'll be on the curb. I had trunks full of, you know, that I'd gone to college with. And it was, what was I finishing? My God, I knew what fork to use. I'd traveled extensively, and now you're going to finish me. I never got the concept of a girl's finishing. But am I, you know, and I thought, I'm out of here. So
just to let you know, I went to all girls Catholic school, and I also went to all girls boarding school.
So, well, this was a boarding school.
Yeah, I know. So I can relate.
Sunday through Thursday, and if you lived in the vicinity, you could go home.
Yep. Yep, I can relate to everything you're saying. It's pretty funny.
I'm not going to get into there were ghosts there and the rattling.
We had ghosts in ours too. Lisa Barry Flynn was our ghost.
Of the beads and not going to that.
Yeah. But I can relate to the. I know this is shocking to my listeners, but I was a little bit of a troublemaker myself in high school and got caught smoking also and sneaking off campus. So we have that in common.
I don't know where you're from, but I'm from Wichita and there's no place to sneak.
Well, I'm from Potomac, Maryland, which is outside of D.C. But my boarding school was in rural Maryland.
So
there was nowhere to go. Yeah, I mean, it's like horse country. Yeah. But we still snuck out.
You were lucky to have a horse.
I didn't have a horse, but it was horse country, and I did ride in boarding school. Yeah, I should have taken a horse, to be honest, to sneak
out.
Right,
that's, you know, I had a horse, and I didn't take it because I didn't know I could. So I left there after 2 weeks and ended up, I guess as a punishment, they sent me to Kansas University. As you could well see behind me, I have Jayhawk the world. And the second day I was there, I met this really cute guy. He was an All-American basketball player, and he was from Ohio, and he was 2 years older than I was. And he was a Jayhawk All-American. So basketball, you know, they're almost number one in the country right now. So, you know, it was quite a prestigious thing. And I said, I'll take him. And 4 years later, we got married. And I was married 51 years. So people say, you know, can't go to college and find a husband. I go, well, maybe. I changed majors constantly. My father was so irritated at me. Because if I was at college at Lawrence, then I didn't have to act nice. And I mean, most people didn't know who I was. And so I didn't have to be the rich girl in town. So I ended up being a dental hygienist because I'd been to the dentist 2 days earlier and my dad said, this is it. What are you going to do? And it was in the 60s. So, you know, women were starting to come into their own and they needed a career. And trust me, I didn't know how to cook, or I guess I could make a bed and gone to camp, but I mean, I was useless. So, you know, and I thought as a dental hygienist, I mean, I never had any idea. And I actually paid a girl that looked very similar to me. Well, she had red hair. And she went to a lot of my classes. She made a lot of money in a semester, making believe she was me. So when I graduated and I had the first two rows of my family, the dean of the school went, and who are you?
Oh, my gosh.
Like, have I ever seen you, lady? And I went, shh. Well, that's, you know. And so if you're going to be a hygienist, you really need to have some tools and like cleaning. And so I did Head Start for a year and just because, you know, I could kind of be hungover and give those kids that little red tablet and they'd chew it up and it'd show they never brushed their teeth. So, I mean, I always found a way out of it, which was something I was very proud of. You know, I got married in 1969 and a huge, huge wedding. And 6 weeks later, my husband got an amazing job offer in San Francisco. I went from Wichita, Kansas to San Francisco and thought I'd probably have to get divorced. I was very used to the country club way of living and arrived there. And he was very clean cut. And, you know, he'd given up his scholarship to play music. And I thought he'll grow out of it. And he didn't grow out of it. He did it for 54 years. So here I am in Marin County. It's 1970, January. I've been married 2 months. Never spent a night alone in a house by myself. And he's going out on tour? I don't think so. Yeah. So I would fly back to Wichita and he was there. And, you know, it's like I'd never seen anybody hitchhike. I thought, how do all of these people have their car break down at the same time? And I mean, it was like bizarre.
Like a whole new world that you weren't used to.
And I'd smoke weed, but I, you know, I felt so bad for them that they didn't have seeds in that weed. You know, I'd go, you know, I was smoking hemp. I wasn't smoking marijuana.
Yeah.
It's made of rope and biggest distributor was in Kansas during the war. So I was, you know, and people were making dresses out of their bedspread, the whole county smelled like patchouli. And I kind of thought it was like body odor, you know, and because I'm like a Chanel girl. So yeah. I just thought, get me out of here. You know, my shoes and purse matched. I was just crazed. And I don't think I ever saw the extremeness of who I was until I ended up there. Didn't fit in, didn't want to fit in. And the music my husband was playing was very eclectic. And do you know who Shel Silverstein is?
Of course I do.
My husband.
Yes, one of my favorite books as a kid.
My husband was playing with him.
Oh, Where the Sidewalk Ends. I love that book.
Yeah, he was playing side gigs with him. And he was having an article in Playboy and a fiddle player with a, you know, garter belt was had her foot up on my husband's, you know, piano bench. It wasn't things I was used to.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, I at that point didn't even know who Shel Silverstein was because the book had not been published when I was a child. And he was lovely, but I was just like such a snob. I go, I can't. I mean, I looked down on them because I was so uncomfortable. I mean, the first time I realized women weren't wearing brassieres, I called my mother. And I thought, oh, God, you're not going to believe this, you know. So I didn't fit in at all. And nor could I figure out how to. You were talking about astrology. I had no idea what sign my husband and I were. And we were both Taurus with Aries rising. And when I heard it, they went, oh, this will never last. I mean, now I've got somebody telling me my marriage is going to last. I've been married like 6 months, you know, because I'm a bull. It was just like from a foreign land. And so he got another big job. He played with the likes of all of them. I'm not name dropping to you, but it was like, you know, it was with the big brother when Janis died. He played with Jimi Hendrix. You know, it's like, and all these people are dying, you know, and I can't tell you I got involved in drugs because I didn't, you know, I'm the girl that never took acid, but twirled around and act like I did.
Yeah.
I mean, I just needed some desperately to fit in. So we moved to LA in 1975, 5 hellacious years in Marin County. And it's so funny because my son lives there now. And it's very different, thank God. But I thought the wheel keeps turning. So we moved down here. And on the way down, my husband was 6'7". I bought a Karmann Ghia because I was supposed to have a Volkswagen. I forgot to put him in it. So it was a little squashed. But, you know, on down we came and I thought I'm going to fit in no matter what. And I never did. I mean, there weren't a lot of people in our situation that were married. I was 23 and he was 25. And, you know, everybody else was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know.
Yeah, that was the time.
And he wasn't allowed to introduce me as his wife. He had to introduce me as his old lady. I was incensed by all of it. And so, yeah. You know, I made the best of it when we moved down here. And he just kept playing with bigger and bigger and bigger people to me. And in 1977, he started playing with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and he was with them for 28 years. And so I'd never heard of them. I thought, teacher, children, what? And I mean, you know, and I'm still very close friends with Stephen and see him a lot. And we stayed very closely connected. And he played with a lot of other people. He was with Monty Raitt for 7 years and Joe Cocker. I mean, he's had a wonderful career. I kind of was never impressed with any of them because it was his job to me, you know?
Yeah.
We had no studio in our house. He played Hammond B3. We had a piano in our house, but I mean, when he walked in the door, he better just have been in Ohio because I wasn't going to put up with the, hey dude, and all that. But kids went to private school, Catholic school. And, so, you know, I never really fit in. And I thought it was because that hole in my soul was from adoption.
Yeah.
And funny that I, in 1986, my mother-in-law came out. I'd lost my father-in-law very suddenly to a massive coronary. And my mother-in-law came out to spend Easter in the spring with us. And she got me. I mean, that's just how I started drinking after my son was born in 1981. My daughter was born in 77. So I was like trying to be a PTA mom and, you know, always a room mother, fabulous parties.
So you were going back a little bit and talking about the piece of the adoption piece, which makes you feel like this hole in your heart. That you're
well, it
never
wasn't in my heart because I knew I was loved. It was my soul about Kansas was one of Kansas and New Jersey were the two last states that had open adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I drove my mother crazy when I was small. And I would go, my mother had a thing about buying a 8 pairs of shoes and she'd wear them around the house and see which ones were comfortable and send the other ones back. So I got this thing about if I'm not comfortable with her, then she'll send me back. Like 3-4 years old.
Major abandonment issues.
Well, attachment, you know, like
attachment. Yeah.
You always get rid of what you didn't want or didn't fit, you know?
Yeah.
My dad, bless his soul. My God, he was such a wonderful man. He made me adopt everything. If I had a puppy, we adopted. If I had a horse, we adopted. If I had a doll, we adopted it. And there were a lot of kids. It was like after World War II, and there were a lot of kids that were adopted. Oddly enough, there are a lot of kids in 12-step programs that are too. So my mother turned to me one afternoon. I mean, I can tell you what I had on. I had little shorts, a little red shorts on and a T-shirt. And I said something like, well, if you don't like it, you can take me back. And it infuriated her. So she said, Candy, your birth mother died in a car accident. And so you are ours. We're never taking you back. There's no place for you to go but here. It was kind of like, you better, you know. She was a lovely woman and very, actually very handsome. She had very much Liz Taylor looks. So she would, you know, caught everybody off guard when she walked into a room. And so just, you know, the opposite of me, the exact opposite of me. And so I said, what does that mean? And she said, she's an angel in heaven and she'll always be watching over you. And so, it was never talked about again. I never mentioned it again. I mean, I've always known I was adopted, but I didn't ever say, okay, to be that. I guess I was 13 or 14, and I was with my father, and we saw this horrible car accident. And I said, oh, that's how my birth mother died. And he goes, what are you talking about? And I said, well, mom told me, you know, years ago that my mom died in a car accident, not to bring it up again. And it was so stunned because he couldn't lie if his life depended on it. He went, oh, well, I guess you forgot to tell me. Oh, come on. And I said, well, I don't know, but, you know, car crashes scare me and all that. And he goes, well, we love you and you're ours anyway, so just get over it. And so I never brought it up again, you know, except now I knew it wasn't the truth.
Yeah.
So it was like, I don't know, it was an overlay in my life, but it was never a big thing to anybody else. I guess that after Mike and I got married and then we moved to Los Angeles and I had my children and now I've started drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother-in-law was a social worker, the bailiff in the small community outside of Dayton called Troy, Ohio. And she was the welfare investigator. I mean, you know, and she was 6'1" and very Irish. Her maiden name had been Kelly. So she said to me, I'm going to take your kids. If you don't get help within 60 days, I'm taking your kids back to Ohio. And I thought, you think you're taking my kids? Are you crazy, lady? And so I had a complete fit about it. And I said, why aren't you saying something to your son? He drinks more than I do. Because boy, could he hold his liquor. And she said, you're raising my grandchildren. And my father-in-law had come from a very alcoholic family. He had 7 kids in the family, and 5 of them were alcoholics. 3 of them died alcoholic. And his father had been an alcoholic and abandonment. So it's like, I just didn't know anything about any. But my parents, of course, had always dressed up to drink cocktail dresses. And that's what I always wanted, was cocktail dresses and matching dyed shoes at 5. So, you know, it was like, it was inbred with me, but I never thought I knew an alcoholic. There happened to be a
lot. Did you think that you, like, did she catch you? Were you hiding it? Was it something like?
Yeah. I hid it in the back tank of the toilet.
Oh, wow. So you were really drinking.
Well, but not when she wasn't there. I mean, when I was by myself, it was just under the sink. And I usually started drinking about the time I'd bathe the kids.
So I didn't drink all day. Yeah. Okay. And were you drinking like wine or?
Oh, I started drinking Jameson's.
Okay.
Irish. And then I went to vodka and grapefruit juice because I thought it was giving me vitamin C. I hate grapefruit juice. I can't stand the smell of it to this day. Then, if I was at the Dodger game or something, I'd have a beer. It had to be a certain occasion because when I started drinking, I drank to match my dress, which is quite an accomplishment. And there aren't a lot of black drinks. So I ended up being a wino.
Yeah.
I had like, you know, really nice crystal Waterford glasses and, you know, and I ended up in a park with a box of wine in my trunk, you know, because it didn't rattle.
Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples.
Anyone else feel like they're talking like this time of year and sneezing and coughing and annoying your family while you're watching TV like I'm sure I do?
Well, yeah, I know that I am because my kids tend to tell me. Luckily for those of us who live with these symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has 2 powerful ingredients in just 1 pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, and itchy nose and throat and sinus congestion and pressure with ease in as little as a half an hour, by the way. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But let me ask you a question. Don't you think that this is, I mean, all the things you've said, first of all, you're a hoot and I think you're hysterical, but what touches me is that you've said, I just wanted to fit in. And I think that that's so common, you know, being a mother, being a mom, having to do all the things that we do and be perfect. You know, I grew up as well in that country club lifestyle. I never really, from a really young age, I've always struggled with abandonment issues myself and liking myself. And I don't know if you can relate to that, but just if I don't, and I have openly admitted on my podcast about, you know, that I lean on wine too much, and I've taken breaks and done the sober curious thing, but it's because I wanted to feel comfortable in my own skin. Yes. And I think that's so common, especially if you come if you're somebody that is feeling uncomfortable, that you just like alcohol is going to take it all away. And then you can be, you know, fabulous candy and wearing the dresses. Oh,
they always say you're thinner, you're brighter, you're funnier, you're cute.
Yeah.
And all of that. It's funny because when I was in Marin County, I had never seen cocaine.
Yeah.
And it was becoming more prevalent, you know, and that rock scene was added to your budget when you made an album. And I thought, oh, I'm scared to death of this, you know, and it was like, very acceptable at places and big behind, you know, backstage and all that. And so I don't know, maybe I was like 28 or 29. And I told Mike, I said, I'm going to try cocaine. He goes, oh, good. Cause I'm a big talker. The first thing that happened is I took this line of coke, and of course it was a $100 bill, and it was a big, huge award show that Mike was playing in. And I thought, well, this is magic. It calmed me down. I cleaned my purse and I went to sleep. That's the first thing I knew that, you know, eventually that I was ADHD. I mean, I had no idea that I could multitask like a mother, you know? And so here I am. So the big joke always in the big rock and roll thing was, don't give her any, she'll clean her purse and go to sleep. And it wouldn't matter where I was. I could just go up to somebody's bedroom, clothe and go to sleep. Cause you know, they were partying late into the night and not me. And so that saved me, I'm sure, because if it would have brought me more alive or I could have drunk more. But I did it like five or six. It was repetitive. It always was the same effect. I never was a pill taker. I was too afraid. I had the Judy Garland thing going on with, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night, you don't know you're taking them and you don't ever wake up again. And I'm not a downer. So I never did downers. They gave me Valium after I had my daughter because I was still on the phone at 3:30 in the morning. But I just was never a pill taker. I was just a good old drunk. Yeah. And, you know, I did everything you're not supposed to as a mother, you know. I made my daughter stay home at school with me because I didn't want to be alone and watch movies and color. And I got sober when my kids were 3 and 6. So, you know, they weren't raised by an alcoholic mother. And my son, he thought it was a lot more fun. He'd go, Mom, maybe you need wine. Because now they had to go to bed at 8, you know, and it was, everything looked very different. And yeah. My kids went to school in fall of 86 and said, when, what did you do for summer? And they went, oh, my parents are alcoholic. I mean, they thought that that meant you didn't drink because they had never heard that word before. And so, it's been in 2 months, it'll be 37 years sober. That's astounding to me.
Congratulations. I think that too, like everything you're saying is, you know, the alcohol industry is glamorized. And especially when you grew up, when you did, you know, my mom is the same, around the same age as you. And she would, you know, tell me stories about like drinking a martini. My mom wasn't a big drinker, but like, you know, like everything was glamorous when it came to alcohol. And to this day, I mean, there like billions, I don't want to say billions, but I can't remember the statistic on how much advertisers spend.
It is billions. It's $2.8 billion.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure on the number, because it's like, you don't see in these commercials the reality. Everything's like, oh, we're at a nightclub and we're beautiful and thin and perfect. And we're drinking, you know, Ciroc vodka with P. Diddy. Like everything is, with everything is,
or yeah, with, you know,
you don't see the reality of what alcohol and drugs and pills really do to you. It's hidden. And it's like a dark secret. It's a dark little secret that's going to like creep up on you.
Yeah, the dirty little secret.
Yeah.
You know, so I had 60 days to get sober before my mother-in-law was coming back. I got furious at her. And so on the 61st day, because come on, it's got to be my idea, I went into treatment, and I called Betty Ford and asked if Miss Betty would call me. I said, I'd like to speak to Betty. It was about 4:30 in the morning. And they said, excuse me? She said, I said, no. I said, well, I'll just leave my number. Could she call me? And when she didn't call me, I got just fear. I ended up being friends with Mrs. Ford, and I always told her the story, and she'd go, well, if I'd have known it, Candy, I'd called you, you know, that's like, and she would have, I'm sure. So, you know, I started in on this journey, and I went to a place that was for only 10 days, and it wasn't 12 step, and got in and got out, and then it was on May 1st of 1986, and my husband said he was going to treatment on Mother's Day. That was my gift. And I was 38 years old, and, you know, somebody came that I didn't know and picked me up that Sunday after I got out of treatment on Saturday and took me to a meeting. And I said, you know, I'm busy. I don't know who you are. I mean, I couldn't talk to you. You're weird. And I walked into the 12-step Studio 12, which was a men's recovery house. That was the industry, the entertainment industry. And, you know, as I went along and Mike got sober, he and David Crosby started being interested in helping other musicians. And they started MAP, which was a musician's assistant program, which morphed into Music Cares. So that's really where I started my career, was volunteering. Like, those guys all got their shit together and they went on tour. And, you know, and I would volunteer to go pick up these musicians and take them to treatment and talk to their wives. That's how it found me. I didn't find it.
Don't you think that's so interesting how life like works itself out? You know, like I say all the time, be happy by making other people happy. That's how I end every podcast. That's what my dad taught me. And through like pain and things that have happened in our lives, you know, like the trauma of whatever it is, that you can turn your story into like really doing something with your life to help other people. And it's so important. And well, what you've done is so huge.
What kept me sober? I wouldn't be.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's nothing worse than a drunk interventionist. So.
Does that, I mean, that must exist. I mean,
there's certainly interventionists now that aren't, it's been bastardized. It's just very sad to me. You
can go
3-day training and be one, because there's no licensing in any state. In the United States of America, you could have a 3-day thing and hang a plaque out and say you're an interventionist.
I have a question about that, because I have talked to Denise about this. So when somebody goes to rehab, right, and they go to get clean for the 30 days or whatever it is, it's an ongoing process, right? So a lot of people
that's the easiest thing you do is go to rehab.
And then, but then there's like, you have to do the work. And a lot of these rehab facilities.
If you say, I don't want to go, I hate 12-step meetings.
Yeah.
I don't like those people. You know, I actually said about the second month, I wouldn't even drink with them. And my husband said that you would if they were buying. But, you know, it's like, if you don't believe it'll work for you, it won't. And I think in the beginning, life was very simple doing my work, but it's very complicated because it's a brain disease. It's not a judgment or a moral issue. And you've got to get help. I mean, 12-step is wonderful to keep you from maybe not drinking and helping others and learning a new way to live, because we all look different, but we all got the same problem. No matter what we're ingesting, it's still altering who we are. And, you know, I had only known one person who was in a 12-step when I got sober, and I didn't like him. I thought he was a pompous ass. And so here I am, you know. So I stuck around because I didn't know where else to go. And these people didn't know me. They didn't have an opinion of me. They didn't know I was married to. My husband was in a men's meeting for 4 years, and everybody thought he was an attorney. So, you know, you can fool some of the people. And then they went to a concert and saw him and said, oh my God, you know.
Yeah.
So we aren't who we are in AA. We need to be either sober or clean or represent and change our lives so we can help other people. So that's what, you know, being of service. And here I am years later, still going. I still sponsor girl. I do everything I'm supposed to do to help another who's suffering. And what an honor and privilege. It, you know, you always hear the only thing you have to change is everything. And it's true.
Let me ask you, because I, you know, watching the show, none of those people want to get clean, right? I mean,
I'll tell you. That's such a weird story about me getting involved with him, but
I would love to know that, by the way, how that happened.
I had a phone call. It was 2004, and this guy said to me, well, I had had 4 or 5 different offers to do a show or, you know, about addiction, and there'd been a show on PBS called The Family After. And I mean, you know, so it was starting to be much more accepted. And there, a lot of famous people were getting sober and staying sober. And so I got this call and said, we want to do a TV show. And the name of it was Intervention. And it's funny because 4 years earlier, I had done a treatment about a show called Intervention, and I'd left it with Mark Burnett and one other reality guy. And I got an option of it for $350 for 3 months, and I never heard from him again. And this show that was being presented to me was my show.
Wow.
And I still have a treatment, but I thought, I'm nobody. You know, I got a better chance. I mean, I didn't ever think it would work. So you're going to go in and you're going to see them getting high and they're going to go to the dealer's house. And, you know, so I couldn't conceive of how it was going to work. I liked the process, but the man, Sam Mettler, who I adore, was going to have it be a comedy. It was kind of a jokey thing. And I said, oh God, count me out. Absolutely not. You're crazy. And I, in 1991, when I went through my training, there were only 5 women interventionists in the country. And so, you know, somebody pounded their fist on the table and said, whenever you're here, the circus is in town. And I said, I'm the ringmaster. And shut the you know, and away I went. So, and I got trained by Dr. Vern Johnson, who created this process. So I had some wonderful opportunities that I didn't know were opportunities at the time. They were blessings. And so away I went. And the show was incredibly authentic. There were just the two of us. There was Jeff von Vonderant and myself. And then, of course, it took off the first year. I did 26 interventions that year. And it was, you know, they held the camera up in the airport and in the airplane and getting off and going to the hotel. All that was cut out finally because, you know, that was awful. Mm-hmm. And I was being paid. I mean, I couldn't belong to a union and I was being paid barely $20 an hour because I was gone for 3 days.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was like, but it got more authentic and more authentic and it really worked. And I was seeing miracles. And I mean, I'd already been an interventionist, you know, so it's since 92. So, I mean, it was like, this is what I did. And it was a lot of people who could not afford treatment. That's the truth. And by the way, the show does not pay for treatment. They don't pay for anything other than, you know, a 3-star hotel for us. And they don't pay for clothes. They don't do reruns. And I got a $300 raise a year. And I thought, you know, I'm doing this as a community outreach for addiction, that this is possible. And, you know, I have a million funny stories, but, you know, the pre-intervention lasted 3.5 minutes instead of 3.5 hours. The crew would get really impatient with me because I took so long educating. And I mean, there were a lot of things that didn't work for me, but it worked for me enough where I had a shot at having somebody save their own life with the grace of God and the help of the show, you know. But, you know, I got a say at that point of what treatment center they went to. And I mean, I was incredibly involved in all of it. And then as the show got, you know, and then they hired this person and they hired that person. And I knew that they weren't properly trained, but we had to have a Black woman. So they got Donna. I mean, it was just that type of thing. So I stuck it out for 11 years.
Do you know the statistic on the cases that you 60%.
Saw? 60%. Okay. At one point, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, 11 people had died on the show. And 60%, if they didn't stay sober that time around, they got the message. And they, you know, but now they're showing this show at in treatment centers. It got out of hand, really.
Yeah. And it just snowballed into like a huge thing.
Well, and then people would, I'd say 75% of everybody that watched it was loaded. I get that. I mean, never has anybody said to me, I used to watch your show. So, you know, and
I wasn't loaded watching it, but I would watch it. I think I watched those things because I don't know if I wanted
to. You wanted to make sure you weren't as bad as they were.
Maybe. I mean, that's a good point. Really,
yeah, that's the presence of it. And here my husband had been this tremendously successful musician. And now I'm getting recognized everywhere.
Yeah. Isn't that funny?
There's the drug lady. You know, I was stunned because at one point, 3.8 million people watched in a week.
Yeah.
And as time would pass, I had some wonderful experiences, just magnificent of helping people and their families. But I was not allowed to stay in touch with the families after the show, which I always do follow up in closure. Wasn't able to do that. And Sam Mettler left, and we got a new executive producer. And then It was four years ago. Last December, I wrote a letter and sent them out. You're not going to compromise my values, and you're not going to make me feel that we are picking the worst possible people to intervene on, not caring what the outcome is. And, you know, I was just as happy if they didn't go to treatment, because it's real life, you know.
It's interesting that you say this too, because this is like a common thing. It, you know, this is TV. So at the end of the day, I don't know if you ever watched that show, The Biggest Loser.
Oh, of course.
It was filmed at Denise's. Yeah. So it's a, oh, it was, I didn't know that. These people would come in, you know, 300 pounds, whatever it was, lose that weight really quickly. And then there's so many cases of these people years later, they gained back all the weight, and it was just like, it's almost like we needed you for this one purpose, which is to be on TV, share your soul, share your stories of pain, why you got to this size. And then that's it. And it sounds familiar.
And they never addressed eating disorders.
Yeah.
They never addressed if you're 150 pounds overweight, most likely you were sexually abused from between 5 and 8.
Yeah.
There was no therapeutic, you know, you still have a fat head and a little tiny body.
And you still have the fat cells that will come back.
Exactly. Yeah. And they had a really good doctor. He actually was a very excellent doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they were so busy exercising and starving themselves to death. You know, there wasn't time for a therapeutic process to bring the family in. And eating disorders, I did my thesis on them. And I got to tell you, it's the hardest thing, because I can live without alcohol for the rest of my life. I can't live without food. And and I've worked with a lot of eating disorders.
I'm a recovering bulimic, so I'm very passionate about it. Yeah, and I use that analogy because what you're saying and caring about people the way that you do just makes so much sense. You know that this is, it's an industry, and at the end of the day, it's entertainment. You know, however it shows up, you know, that's what it is.
Well, and you know, what you have to realize is this is a lifelong commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the 12-step programs and stuff that are associated with eating disorders are not a success.
Mm-hmm.
Because they demand a certain amount of, you know, if you have lima beans instead of green beans, and it's like, it isn't what it was ever set out to be, which is torture. And it's called the HOW program.
Well, okay. let me ask you this, like, for the sake of time. I want to touch on it's so important to talk about the root of why people do what they do, and you know, the pain of trauma from childhood or whatever it is, the reason why people turn to alcohol or they turn to drugs. You know, it usually stems from having some sort of trauma as a child. And that is such a huge issue in our country. Is, you know, if we don't get to the root of why people have these addiction issues, and we just like put them in 12-step programs and then they throw them out on the street. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't care who you are. Mm-hmm. If you don't have anything wrong with you other than you might have a HAD addiction.
Mm-hmm.
As I look over your shoulder.
I do have a HAD addiction. That's my hat wall.
And so, you're going to learn a new way of living that is magnificent in 12 steps. So throwing anybody in 12 step, I mean, I've had people that I sponsored that weren't alcoholics and addicts. They had a traumatic situation in their life and turned to drugs and alcohol, but they never had the behavior. And that's what I trigger. Alcohol and drugs are a symptom of what's really going on with us. Any treatment center that takes you in and starts doing heavy trauma treatment is crazy. You can't do trauma treatment when you're 2 weeks sober. I mean, it's been eating you alive. So I'm a big, huge fan of a place called The Meadows. It has a week-long program called Survivor, and it's how you survived your childhood. I've done it twice. And it was so, I went as a professional and then I went back 2 weeks later because how dare you call me an orphan?
Mm-hmm.
It grabbed hold of me. I've sent probably 300 or 400 people there for many situations, but mainly we all have early childhood trauma, but it's different, but it feels the same. So when that word trauma came in, I felt like it was kind of like herpes. Don't do this, don't get, you know, or ADHD or bipolar. I mean, you know, we've gone on these clicky things. I truly believe that when you get sober, you have to work at staying sober. If you're not going to 12-step to me, then you might be sober, but you're not in recovery. There's a process of being accountable, of talking about your feelings, of telling the truth, that is not accustomed to us. We lie, we cheat, we steal. All of us in one way or the other. And I think you have to continue on. I hate programs that put you on a bunch of, you know, drugs, antidepressants, and just to sleep. And I mean, it's like, then they're dependent on something else that's going to make them okay. I know from experience of years and years of watching and trying to help people, we all have a mental malady. This is a mental disease. Who gets up every day and tries to kill themselves and says, no, I'm fine. You know,
for the sake of time, I wanted to touch on one last thing because I could talk to you all day. I hope that we've remained friends.
I want to do a program on adoption.
I would love to do that because that's a huge thing. And I want to connect you. I want to connect you with my friend, Mary, who talks about.
I mean, I know who she is.
Okay, because she talks a lot about closed adoption and like what it does to a human being and all of that stuff. But I do love to end the show in a positive way, always, if I can. And I know that you lost your husband, which I'm so sorry to hear. And what I love about what you said to me is David Crosby just recently passed.
Yeah.
And I will tell you what's weird is I love the song Hero. I listen to it all the time. I listen to it in my car. It's one of my favorite songs. I think it's the most beautiful song. And what touches my heart is the fact that that means that your husband and David are connected. I believe in that stuff.
Oh yeah, so do I.
Yeah.
And my husband was very close with Etta James, and she's up there, and Joe Cocker's up there. I mean,
he's got lots of friends.
Yeah, he didn't go up there. He's not lonely. And yeah. I'm a deep believer that his presence will always be with me. I'll never be the same, but I'll be okay. But I have to tell you something, Megan, I've got purpose.
You do have purpose.
You know, and Mike for years was my higher power before I got sober, as is David's wife, Jan, who I just got a text from 20 minutes ago, saying the world was blessed to have them in it. And we got to be lucky enough to marry them, you know, the love of our lives. So I'm grateful for a lot of things. I'm pissed at him all the time when I have to clean the gutters. But, you know, the real truth for me is that he believed in the human race, and he believed that the best thing we could do was love one another. And music brought us, it was a universal language. So I have many benefits from all of that. Am I happy? No. And the grieving process is very personal. My daughter does it completely different. Every day it's got something about her dad and his music. And my son is a very acclaimed musician, and he brings it out in his music. So we all are still grieving, but I'm a lot better than I was. Trust me. I understand this grief thing is like, and I lost my mom and my dad.
Friend, you've gone through a lot.
Well, I lost my best friend of 60 years the week before I lost my
friend. Yeah, loss is grief, and loss is, it can be a lifelong process.
Well, but
I like to say, but it's what you can like bring to it and remember. And do you have a sign? I'm going to close on that. What do you have a sign that he's with you? I would love to hear it.
I'm not looking for it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to start going, oh, there's a white butterfly. And it's, you know, because he wasn't a white butterfly, trust me. Me, at first, you know what I thought it was? Quarters.
Ah.
I'd get in the car and there'd be a quarter on the floor. I'd look down and think there was a quarter and it wasn't there before. But he's worth more than 25 cents, you know. I mean, it's like, it's, but it was like just very odd. I had a very hard time listening to his music. He was prolific. He was a fabulous singer, great musician. And I have a hard time listening to it because a lot of times I shared that piece of him. It was his. It was all his, and this was all mine. And we shared a life together. But I'm not looking for. But somebody just asked me if I was gonna date. I'm 73. I said, yeah, if he's 98, has 6 weeks to live, a billionaire, and has no kids, and will leave me everything, I'll think about it.
Oh, my God, that's hysterical.
Because, you know, am I going to date? Are you out of your mind? I always have said, you know, I'll be okay, you know. Do I like it? No.
But you have your purpose, like you talked about. Candy. And just so you know, when you're ready to see signs, because you're still in the very early process of this, you'll see them, and I believe in that. I believe.
I do too. And my mother, it's so funny.
Yeah.
My mother was about as squared up as you can get, high society. And I always wear pearls. I've worn pearls since I was 12 because it makes you look like a lady. That's what she said to me. Like, I didn't have to act like one if I had pearls.
I love it.
But my mother was a deep believer in reincarnation. So I've always kind of grown up with that, you know?
Yeah.
We'll see, you know?
When you're ready, you'll see it. I've lost my sister and my dad and my best friend. And my sign, I always feel like my best friend's super close. And it really is butterflies because I really have like had so many crazy experiences with it. That they just come to me when I really need them. So, and I'm very spiritual. I know that God's with me every day of my life.
I know
we're going to see them again. And the best thing about you is that you live your life helping other people. And that's what it's about.
Did you see the cartoon Soul?
No.
Watch it.
I will.
Phenomenal.
Andy, I adore you. You're the best.
I just am so happy. Now I have to meet you. Now I have to come to Manhattan Beach.
Oh my God, let's have lunch. Everyone, in closing, thank you, Candy. You're awesome. Thank you, Denise, because she sends me all these angels and she's one of my little angels.
Your agent.
Yeah. She's my agent now. Thank you, Denise. In closing, everyone, be happy by making other people happy. Thank you.
Judging Megan with Megan Judge.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.